following speech was recorded this week at the Ina Levine Jewish Community Campus in Scottsdale, Arizona, entitled A Conversation with Yishai Fleischer. Is settler a bad word?
Everybody, shalom. Thank you so much for coming out. I want to thank a few people. First thing, thank you very much to the BJE, okay, Board of Jewish Education. Thank you very much. Thank you to the Lane. Where's Lane? Where'd you go? There he is. Shalom. I want to thank also McCore for co-sponsoring the event today. A good friend of Arthur Rolon Rothstein does a great job. He's bringing a new spirit here in town. And of course, it's lovely to be at the JCC again. It's a great place. You're very lucky to have such an amazing venue. I also want to thank especially Jake. This guy over here is tireless, and you are very lucky to have a person like him in your community who is, every time I call him, he's either at some three-hour meeting for Israel, APAC board, this board, that board, and he's working to really connect you to Israel and Israel to you, and I honor that very much. Thank you so much, and thank you for helping me come out here on such short notice. Folks, I see that we're a little bit lacking in some caffeine right now, okay? So let me explain to you. I don't care if you hate me, I don't care if you love me. Just do it vociferously, okay? You're gonna like what I say, big smile, applause, get excited. Hate what I say, boo me, throw a tomato, just be excited. That's all I care about. A lot of heat, okay? A lot of energy. We have to be in high energy. That's all I'm asking for, okay? Can you buy that? Yes, it's a high energy night, all right? In order to make it a little bit more higher energy, I have brought for you a bottle of wine. I'm not opening this one. This is a bottle of wine, one of the best in Israel. It's called Machpelah. It's made in Hebron, the place where I work. This is the tombs of the mamas and the papas right here, okay? Who here is Jewish? Okay? Who here is friends of the Jewish people? Thank you, thank you. Thank you very much for coming. All of us here owe everything to these people. The Jewish people, who is the children of these people, and anybody else who's in this room, is the spiritual child of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah, okay? They are buried in Hebron. In Hebron, we have a Jewish life there, and we make an amazing wine as well. And we're gonna raffle off this amazing bottle of wine, which retails in Los Angeles, California, for $65, okay? This is an excellent bottle of wine. How do I know that it costs $65 in Los Angeles? Because that's where I bought it. See, the thing is, I'm not gonna lug this thing across the ocean and have it break in all my stuff. But somebody else is already doing that, so this is from my town. But when I get to LA, I buy it there, and then I bring it to you here. So if you have to get some more, you can get it in LA. In any case, so how we're gonna do this is very simple. I'm gonna give you my hat. You put in a card, but I want on this card your name and your email address, okay? And put it in here, either a card or a piece of paper, and we'll pass it out. At the end of the evening, we're going to pick out a name. Somebody's gonna win this fine bottle of wine. Does that sound exciting? Okay, great. And even there's some consolation prizes as well. So here you go. Start the process in the meantime. You can handle this by yourself.
One card only.
One card only, friends. Read the thank you, Pinchas. Thank you, Paul. I want to say to you that I'm here tonight really. Really, I had to be in Los Angeles in the beginning of the week and in San Diego for some very important meetings. And I will be at the end of this weekend, I will be in Las Vegas for the first time in my life. I'll be in Las Vegas, okay? And I promise the people in Hebron that I'm going to double any donations that we make. I'll do that in Vegas. That's a joke. Anyway, and in between Los Angeles and San Diego and Vegas is a beautiful town called Phoenix. And I have a lot of friends here. And so I said to myself, what an opportunity to come and join you and to come to this beautiful venue. We wanted to think of some topics to talk about, and I'm going to talk about tonight about really a question that a lot of you have, which is, does Israel do a good job of presenting itself, right? A lot of you will say to me, Israel's got a PR problem. Yes? Yes. Israel doesn't do a good job of presenting itself, or various ways of saying these things. And there's a lot of truth in that. Give credit to the other side also, that they're doing a great job at delegitimizing Israel. That's a separate lecture I have called The Genius of the Jihad. There's something brilliant about the Jihad. You ever notice that? There's something brilliant. How do you victimize wherever you go, yet always play the victim?
There's something brilliant about that. You got to give it to them, right? Or here's another one. If let's say you were a part of the jihad and you wanted to delegitimize Israel, you wanted to say that Israel's an occupier, where would you start? Would you go for Hebron, where we've had a Jewish community for 3,800 years? Is that where you would start? Not me. If I was a jihadist, I would start with Tel Aviv, 100-year-old city, right? Built on sand dunes and partially an Arab neighborhood. I would start there because it's easy, right? Because you guys are Johnny-come-latelys, right? Makes sense. I wouldn't go for Jerusalem. I mean, every person knows that Jerusalem is Jewish. That's like almost synonymous. But these guys have such audacity, really chutzpah, jihadist chutzpah, you know? And their chutzpah is that they go for the big ones. They say, Jerusalem, that's not Jewish. That's a Palestinian capital. Right? Or they say, Hebron, that's not the tombs of the fathers and mothers. That's not the Machpelah. That's the Ibrahimi Mosque. You have to be both brilliant and incredibly audacious to go for that. That's what I call the genius of the jihad. And the biggest part of the genius of the jihad is the last thing I'm going to tell you, which is the biggest and most powerful part of the jihad today, as it's in its war against Israel, is that they've managed to make our own young people fighting against our own country. That is brilliant. It's one thing to be like a Nazi, get a brown shirt, young people, find a German kid, turn him into a Nazi. I get it. But to take our kids and to get our kids to claim that Israel is a repressive regime when it's the most enlightened country in the Middle East and one of the most enlightened countries in the world, to get our own campus kids to be able to say Israel is bad because it oppresses people when it's the only light of liberty in the whole Middle East, it's brilliant. How do you even pull that off? There has almost never been an anti-Semitism that has been so successful in garnering support amongst the people that they're actually against. There's something brilliant about that. Maybe the communists were good at bringing Jews over to their side and causing them to be a kind of anti-Jewish. Maybe the Greeks were good at bringing Jewish people over to become Hellenists. But to really be anti-Israel like this, there's a brilliance to the jihad. Okay, and tonight we're gonna, I drove here from Los Angeles today, okay? By the way, I did that by choice. I could have flown, but I wanted to drive here. I wanted to see the desert. I like to see the desert. And I was thinking about our talk tonight. So I made a preface in my head, but it just came back to me now. Okay, so just one step back for a second. How is the state of Israel doing, friends? Wonderful. Awesome. That's absolutely correct. Anybody else agree with that? Woo. High energy, friends. Yes or no?
Yes.
I'm Israel high, and it hasn't been so high in a long time. Still, though, there are issues. So how do you understand on the fact, on one hand, what I just said a minute ago, which is our own kids are being turned anti-Israel, on the other hand, Israel's doing great. How do you know Israel's doing great?
Well, they're in the top as far as production,
as far as startup companies. Okay, economy's doing great. Let me tell you also another thing. When I was born, there were 3 million Jews in Israel. Today, there's 6.5 million. We are slated by 2050 to be 20 million people in Israel. Okay? The population is exploding. The economy is matching it, if not even doing better than ever before, and supporting this population growth. So fabulous thing. So I'm still a little jet lagged. How do we reconcile? Thank you. Exactly. Thanks, Doug. How do we reconcile these two trends? Well, I asked a guy who is the head of Im Tirtzu. Have you ever heard of Im Tirtzu? Great campus movement in Israel. I said to him, Matan, is Israel doing good or bad? He says to me, depends if you're going to zoom in or zoom out. Zoom in or zoom out. That's what he said to me. Zoom out, how are we doing? Amazing. We haven't done this well in 2,000 years. I don't think we've done this well in 3,000 years. We're probably in better shape now than in Davidic and Solomonic times. Okay, amazing. Population growth, economic growth, I forgot to mention, also return to tradition, and interest in Torah learning, in our traditional values. So tremendous time. On the other hand, when you zoom in, You know, even if you take a supermodel and you zoom into one of the pores here, it's not the most beautiful thing, right? So on zoom in, there are things that are not so attractive. So before we, I just had this idea that we really have to, before we can go on to this night, we have to remember first thing, things are good. What kind of speaker am I going to be if things are good, then what, you don't need me, right? But please remember that things are good, very good. God is great, we're living in amazing times, and we should be very, very thankful. Now, let's zoom in to deal with issues, but not allow those issues to depress us, okay? I don't want anybody leaving tonight's talk and thinking, sheesh, I spoke, and, you know, things are shaky. No way. No way, Jose. And the reason that's also important is because when you deal with people who are anti-Israel, you have to have a little bit of smugness when you're dealing with them. And recently I had a reporter from Denmark, and she's given me the old reporters, you know, what they do. I don't know if you know, I deal with a lot of anti-Israel reporters, and she's given me the business. I said to her, how many people are there in Denmark? How many Danes are there? She's like 5 million. I'm like, we're 6.5 million. We're bigger than them. Just get that straight. Like, we're bigger. How's your economy? Oh, look at that. Our GDP is higher than theirs. Interesting. Just first, before you even go too much farther and give you the business, just take it easy and remember that we are doing very, very well. At the same time, now we're going to sink in a little bit into the issues. We will zoom in and deal with them so that we can do better at the issues that we're struggling with, okay? Okay, so I am a settler. Does anybody agree with that or does not agree with that terminology? Well, that's the title of today's talk. Am I a settler? Do you like that word or not? Well, come on, let's go, people. Oh, if you think this is gonna be one of these Jewish talks where we don't touch the issues that are uncomfortable, you can forget it. We're dealing with the issues today. Yes?
You can't settle your own mind.
You cannot settle your own mind? Is that exactly correct? Let's think about that. Here in America, the settlers, were they settling their own land or not exactly?
They call them pioneers.
Pioneers, good. Okay, so you prefer the word pioneers. You don't like the word settler. I get it. Good, let's open it up. Anybody else?
Resettler.
Okay, we'll get to that in a minute. That's, of course, a fine point. All right, you know what? I'll get to it right now. There's no question that we're settling our land. We're building it. We're growing it. But we see ourselves as, ironically, both the settler and the indigenous native. We're kind of meeting ourselves. We're resettling, re-pioneering our land. What's a good word for that? Reinvigorating, repatriating. Repatriating. That's a nice word, right? We're repatriating our land. So we're both the settlers and the natives. Okay. Why is the word settler come to me? My wife has a settler cookbook. Do any of you ladies have a settlement cookbook? Settlement cookbook, right? So my wife has got, she loves that one. So settlement used to be an okay word. Why has it come to mean a negative thing? Why is that?
Occupier.
Right. Good. Good, Dr. Brodsky. Exactly right. The idea is that, I'll explain to you the philosophy behind it. The idea is we want to now paint the Jews as foreigners in the land of Israel. It's not the land of Israel. It's Palestine. It's not Judea. Right? That's the actual name of this land. This is Judea. Judea sounds a lot like Jews, right? That's, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu's famous line, Chinese people are from China, French people are from France, Jews are from Judea, right? But they want you to erase all that, and they want to create an atmosphere by which we are illegitimate in this land, and therefore we are, the new word is occupiers, right? Foreigners. And when you're an occupier and a foreigner, you automatically become an abuser. Because you're on somebody else's land, even if you're benevolent, there's an abuse element in it. Because you're not on your place, and you shouldn't be ruling this land mass. So their whole thing, the psychology behind the attacks on us today, is to say that you are foreigners in this land. And foreigners automatically means you're abusers. Now, you go to APAC. Who's coming to APAC in 3 weeks? I'll be there, okay? We have, by the way, an awesome event at APAC. A Judea and Samaria event, a breakout on Monday afternoon, sushi and wine from Judea and Samaria. So I'm at APAC. Outside, young people, including young Jews from campus, are saying, Israel, stop the occupation. Right? But how do we Jewish organizations answer that claim that we're foreigners in our own land? They say, where's my cell phone? Oh, can I borrow a cell phone for a second?
They say,
you love occupying! And we say, hey, but we invented the cell phone. Right? You're stealing somebody else's land, you're stealing our land. Hey, but we have gay rights. You've stolen our land! Hey, we go to Haiti and we help people. We're the good guys. Now what the problem is that this is not an answer to the claims. That's a bunt or a, what do you want to call it? A fouling off on the ball. You're not actually hitting it. The question is being posed. So I'm at AIPAC last year, and outsiders screaming occupation, occupation. And inside, we have Alan Dershowitz, one of the great defenders of Israel. I don't agree with him all the time, but I love his passion to fight for Israel. I don't agree with his positions always, but I love his zeal. The guy's a fighter. He's like a prize fighter. He loves to fight, right? Surgeons like to cut. Dershowitz likes to fight. And he's out there, but you know what he's talking to people about? Look at Israel's new water technology. Dershowitz, we don't need you to sell technology. We need you to answer the claims. Are we stealing somebody else's land or not? And so the word settlement or settler has become a negative word. It's there to say you are a foreigner. And how do we think of ourselves? Do we think of ourselves as foreigners in this land?
No,
of course not.
Some think in that way.
Some think that way, right. Those are put into that. But you know what I think? I think that there's nothing more beautiful, nothing more organic, nothing more holistic than the Jewish people in Judea. There's nothing more beautiful than a Jew living in Hebron. We've lived there for 3,800 years. Our stories are infused with that town, from Abraham and Sarah to King David, Herod, King David, Maimonides comes there. It's such an integral part of our story. There's nothing more beautiful than Jews living there. So why do I still use the word settler? Did you guys read my New York Times article? It was called A Settler's Vision for the Future of Israel. Some of my colleagues were very upset that I used this word settler. In Israel, they say, don't call me a settler, call me Echanachomri. And you go meet Nacher, I mean, no, Mitashir, they say.
Mitashir.
Whatever, it doesn't translate exactly, but I'm not a settler, I'm a resident, I'm part of a nascent. But why do I use the word settler? Because we already established it's not such a good word, right? It falls into the category that they want to build for me. You're a foreigner, Yishai. You're not from here, Yishai. You're an occupier. You're a settler. In Arabic, mustawtin. Okay? And I once did a not such a great interview. I was arguing with Ali Abu Nima. Wasn't a good interview for me, for various reasons. But in any case, he says, you settler! And he's constantly calling me this word settler, a negative word. But I have come to embrace the word settler. Why? I've changed tactics. You know, Jews, by the way, we love words. We don't. The right-wing Jews are like, they say, East Jerusalem. We say, not East Jerusalem, but Eastern Jerusalem. There's no East Jerusalem. All these little words that the right-wing Jews always like to fight for, right? But I now use the word settler on myself. Why? Because I picked it up from the gay lobby. Do you remember when I was a kid, the word gay meant a slur against homosexual people? It was like a negative term. But what do? They walked towards the fire. They took that term and embraced it. And they said, yeah, we are gay. That's exactly what we are. And I learned from them. They actually have a book about their tactics. It's called Behind the Wall. And I read the book and I said, oh my God, this is a perfect thing. I'm going to tell everybody, yes, I'm a settler. I am a settler. I am a proud settler. Why? Because I'm the Jew that's standing up for our rights in this land in Judean area. Yes, I'm that kind. I'm the kind that employs courage and is willing to get out there and even risk danger in order to hold on to this land. And yes, hear me clearly, I am against the two-state solution. Not because the other guys are not deserving of getting our land at this time because they're the bad guys. No, because this is my land. And it's always going to be my land. It was historically my land, continues to be my land. It's true legally, it's true historically, it's certainly true religiously, etc. Jews are from Judea, not Palestine. And I'm going to stand up and say that. And when you're done tonight, you say, I heard a settler speak, because he spoke with clarity about his belief system, and now I can, that negative term that was used against him, he's embraced it. He wants people to see, yes, these are the pioneers of Zionism today. And so I've actually taken a term, which I agree is a negative term, and said, yes, let's say it. Yes, sir. But we'll keep questions short, we'll get to the end, but go ahead.
You have the gay community who had victim status that they embrace. With embracing the settler term, there's still a lot of victims who have everyone's empathize.
Fabulous. Excellent point. You're 100%, you nailed it. Did you hear the question? He said the gay community used a victim status. They are abused, and you, settler, you're kind of the abuser. And so therefore, you're not going to be able to enjoy that same, right, empathy, right? Good, great question. Well, I speak to groups almost every day in Hebron. First thing I ask people is, and this is amazing, I do this with many groups, and you know what, I can do it here as well. You don't have to, I'm going to ask a question, you don't have to raise your hand. How many of you feel like you know how many Arabs there are in the Middle East? Don't worry about it, yes or no. Just do you know or not? Because, ladies and gentlemen, if you do not know this number, you have a problem because you don't understand what's really going on. With respect. Because the reason I respect you is because a minute later now you actually will know. So I'll have more respect for you. All right? The answer is very simple. 350 million. The Shema? 350 million. That's the number of Arabs, not Muslims, Arabs in the Middle East, from West Africa to the Persian Gulf. I'm not including Turks. I'm not including Persian Iranians. I'm including just Arabs, because there are over a billion Muslims in the world. Most of them are in our region also, so I'm not even including them. Just Arabs is 350 million. CIA fact book will corroborate that. How many Jews are there in the Middle East? 6.5 million. 8 million citizens in Israel, 6.5 of which are Jewish, right? That is the reality of the Middle East. The reality is these men, now, does that mean that is every Arab an enemy of Israel? Not at all. But it is true that jihadism is a popular milieu, a very popular ideology today in Israel. I separate between jihadists and Arabs and Islam. I separate those terms. It's the difference between Nazi and German. Not every German was a Nazi. But every Nazi is an anti-Semite, right? More or less. You could say that if you're a Nazi, you identify with, if you're German, you're not necessarily a Nazi. It's true that most Nazis were Germans. But I separate that out in order to say, here's what I'm fixated on. The Middle East state is jihadist, generally speaking. And there's 350 million people who potentially would embrace jihadism. And there's 6.5 million Jews. So what is Israel? It's a small ethnic enclave, or even ethnic autonomy in an Arab region. Okay? Get that first, that fact first straight, and then you'll understand who is indeed, what did you call it? A victim. Right, but this message, by the way, is zero ideological. It's just plain facts that people don't know. Students do not know that. Because one of the other successes of the Palestinian narrative is that they're the small and we're the big. And that's genius. I see there are a few people here with some gray hairs. Am I right? I see a few folks. You do recall that we have fought many wars against not just the Palestinians, but against 6 Arab armies combined. Everybody knows that it used to be the Arab-Israeli conflict, but they have shifted the discussion to making it about Palestinians subjugated by the big bad Jew. By the way, something I want to tell you between you and me. I have learned something about anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a general feeling. Somebody is, in my opinion, either is or is not an anti-Semite. Then they look for reasons to feel that feeling, because being an anti-Semite is not really a legitimate thing in society, in polite society. Therefore, I'm an anti-Semite, I need a reason. Oh, look, they're abusing the Palestinians. Perfect. I knew it. Okay, that is just a general thing I've realized, that people that hate Jews are always looking for a reason to really substantiate their hate. It's not the other way. It's not that what we do and when we do something not nice that causes more anti-Semitism. That is my opinion, it doesn't work that way. Generally speaking, societies do good and bad things, including Jewish societies. And we do mostly good things. And we're always trying to prove that we're doing good things. We'll get to that in the next example. But we don't have to try so hard to prove that we're doing good things. We're famously good people. And the anti-Semites are there because that's what they believe. And they're looking for rationales, and they'll find it. They'll always find it. In any case, your point is well taken, but I still stand firm that I'm embracing the term these days. And I'm saying, yes. And when I get up in front of a liberal crowd, which I do often, and very well may be liberal folks in this room, and I welcome you very much. By the way, I'm liberal. Because I believe in liberty. That's what the word liberal means. It comes from the word liberty. I am liberal. I am much more liberal than anybody who's for the jihad, who tacitly supports ethnic cleansing of Jews from their ancestral homeland. What is a more liberal issue than this tribe of people returning to its ancestral homeland, regaining rights? There's nothing more beautiful, more liberal than that. Who should be protected? The big jihad or the small Jewish people who are trying to come back home and assert rights? Assert their rights to their ancestral homeland. So that's issue number one. So settler, so how do we finish up? Good word or bad word? No, it's a bad word, but I'm embracing it. I'm embracing it. I'm going to take it all the way. And I think that, and I can tell you from my position, is that I'm trying to say to people, when I speak in front of these groups, so oftentimes I'll say to young people, today you're meeting a settler. You've heard a lot about us, and here I am. Now, I'm not going to tell you a truth. I'm not going to convince you of anything. I'm not trying to, but I will share with you my narrative. And then they're going to come out being like, I heard the settler narrative, and I may have not liked it, but it made at least sense. I understood where he's coming from, and he's certainly not a monster. That's, to me, a win. I don't try to win by getting people to believe, to agree with me. I want them to just understand there's rationality. Okay, so that was, now I want to tell you a story. I have three stories. You guys like stories? I love stories. Stories make all the difference, okay? Here's my story. This is story number one. I live today in Efrat. I moved recently to Judea. Beforehand, I was living in eastern Jerusalem, on the Mount of Olives. I'll tell you two stories about the Mount of Olives. I had I can see that again, because there's a few gray hairs here. You remember Christiana Mampour? Yeah. Young people don't have any idea who she is. So Christiana Mampour, remember her? With a helmet and a foxhole, right? She was great. By the way, sharp as a whip. Smart like anything. She's Persian. She's married a Persian. She's a smart lady. Right? No, she's married a Jew. She's herself is Persian. Very, very, very smart lady. She was on my balcony on the Mount of Olives, overlooking the Mount of Olives. She says to me, but Mr. Fleischer, don't you know you're living in occupied land? I said to her, Christian, how could you say that? How could you say I'm living in occupied land? Look at this mountain with 180,000 Jewish graves from the last 3,000 years. Do you honestly want to tell me that I don't have a right to live in my people's ancestral burial grounds? Do you know what just happened, friend? I said that to her. I went the most left you could go. I went American Indian on her. Okay? I said ancestral burial grounds. You cannot go more left than that. Ooh, you're out. You're shut out.
I want you out.
Ancestral burial grounds. So she stutters step for a second. She's smart. She says, yes. But you do know you're an obstacle to peace. Yeah? Okay. Thanks. You see this guy, Jake? A problem, he solves it. That's the way it is. All right. So, yeah, this sounds good. So she says to me, you're an obstacle to peace. I said to her, if you mean I'm an obstacle to putting a wall down the middle of this city, separating it out by ethnicities in what you call progress and I call regression, that's not progressive, that's regressive. Yes, I'm an obstacle to that kind of peace. Let me just put it to you this way, friends. My wife shot that interview as a video. I have it as proof that that went on, but for some reason it didn't make it onto her show, okay? Okay. So that's story number one. That's about settlement. Here's another story for you about Eastern Jerusalem. For many years, when I moved to the Mount of Olives, I tried to shop at the Arab stores. Do you know why? Because I believe in coexistence. I believe in cooperation. I'll explain to you later why I don't believe in the word peace. But I believe in coexistence. I tried to shop, but you know what the Arabs told me? Don't shop in our stores. Why? Why does an Arab person in East Jerusalem tell me not to shop in a store? What? Don't be embarrassed. Throw it out. What do you think? That's right. Other Arabs are going to see me walking into your store, and they're going to say, why are you being friends with this Jew, with this settler, this Mustalta? So, okay, so I respected them. I don't want them to get injured. But one day, after I hadn't been in that store in like a year, I'm walking past the store, Arab store, and I see a poster of a fist smashing the Star of David. So that's it. That boiled my blood. And I walked right into that store, Arab store. And you gotta be a settler, you see? You gotta be a tough guy, you know? You gotta walk in. It's an Arab store. Other Arabs are shopping there. Walk right in there. And I said, Daoud. Now, what is Daoud? Daoud is the Arab form of David. Okay? I said to Daoud. And I knew the guy from before. I said, what is this thing? What is this thing? You have municipal services from us. The street cleaners come by. It's Jerusalem. Your electricity. Israeli electricity. You, the police here. Everything is from Jerusalem, from municipal Jerusalem. You're in Israel. How could you have this poster? So what does he say to me? He says, you settler, you Mustalta. He starts yelling at me, giving me the whole nine yards. He's throwing a book at me, right? He's doing the whole thing. Now, in the meantime, there's Arabs in the store, right? And they just shuffle out. He just starts yelling at me. They are out. Within 60 seconds, there's not one other person in the store. Then he comes up to me, close to my face, and he says, Isha, don't be stupid. I said, what? Now, this is the Middle East, right? Middle East, you could be very angry 1 minute, next minute. He says to me, don't be stupid. I said, what? What do you mean? He said, what does this poster say? I said, I don't read Arabic. He says, don't buy from Israel. Boycott Israeli goods. I'm like, okay. He goes, come here. Look at my fridge. Tnuva, Strauss, all Israeli products. He goes, Ishai, everybody in this neighborhood, Ras El Amud, knows I sell Israeli products. I'm feeling stupid here, okay? So therefore, what he goes, he says to me, Ishai, I put this poster up so that the jihadists that walk past say, it's okay, Daoud is with us. But everybody knows what I sell here. But I have to put this up. This is my mezuzah. True story. He said that. Then he says to me, and this is the most important part for you to hear. He says to me, Ishai, let me ask you a question. If, let's say, these jihadists come in and burn down my store, is your police going to investigate it? No. Is your insurance company going to insure my store? No. So I'm forced, because you don't assert strength and sovereignty in this area, I'm forced that I have to put up this poster. That doesn't mean, by the way, he's a big Israel lover. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But he puts that up because we're not doing our job of being a strong sovereign in the Middle East. That's what I mean by settler. When I use that word, I mean to say it's time to say it more clearly and vociferously. To make it in the Middle East, you have to be a strong sovereign. That's the way things work. Okay? We're going to mull that point over, right? That's a big story, right? That's a story that takes a little bit of... It's a true story. And it takes a little bit of thinking to understand it. Okay, topic number two. So we talked about being a settler. We talked about, if it's a good word, bad word. We talked about asserting. And also, by the way, something I believe in very much is clarity. We Jewish people and Jewish organizations, we tend to sweep issues under the rug. We tend to not deal with things we don't like. And we just put up a happy, nice face. But that's not the way to do it. You've got to talk about the issues that are icky and air them out. Make it clear. This is also true about, I'm not going to do this talk tonight here, about the two-state solution as an idea. We know that we're not going to do the two-state solution because we can't. Because there's too many Jews in Judea and Samaria and the West Bank. Because we can't give it to the Palestinian Authority because they're jihadists. And because it's the high ground and they would be able to shoot at us from there. And because it's failed recurrently. But we keep telling people that we're going to do it, including many organizations that you're involved in. Right? We're going to be in APAC next month. They're going to try to prove to us it's still happening. Two-state solution. 40 years later, still trying. It's going to happen, I promise. Sometime it's going to happen. It's not. But we fib. And I'm against that. I'm for clarity. When I deal with Europeans all the time, I say, my European friends, I agree with you about one thing. There's no such thing as a settlement policy and the two-state solution. It can't coexist. That's true. And I'm not going to fib you. I'm going to tell you clarity what's really going on. Okay, issue number two. Maybe it's related. Peace. Good word or bad word? How do you feel about peace? Good word or bad word? This is a nice lady behind you. Yes, ma'am. But is it a nice word? It's a beautiful word, right? That's right, look at her. That face said everything. She did this thing. It's like, peace. It's the ultimate value. And indeed, our sages say, peace is the vessel that holds all goodness in this world. Peace. Shalom. Shalom is one of the names of God. Do you know that in Jewish law, you're not supposed to say the word shalom in the bathroom? So if your buddy comes into the bathroom, you don't say shalom. You say, hey. You say, manishma. You say, but you don't say shalom. Yes?
It's an irrelevancy. The word should be quiet.
What?
The word should not be peace. It's pride for
it. Oh.
The word should be quiet.
Quiet. Interesting. Okay. You know what? You really led me right into the topic. Thank you. You know where you have quiet? You have quiet on the border between Canada and America. There's quiet there. Right? Like Lake Wobegon, there's quiet there, you know? There's quiet between the Atlantic and the Pacific. Here, it's quiet. Okay? There's no quiet in those. That's not the way things work. I appreciate what you're saying, but I gotta tweak it. Because I agree with you, the word peace is not the right word, but it's certainly not quiet, because just not the way it works. In the Middle East, it's deterrence, it's strength, it's honor, it's fear. That's the way it works in the Middle East. It works through honor. And what is honor? If I mess with that guy, he will mess me up. I respect and honor the fact that he's strong. I never use the word peace because the word peace no longer means what it means to us. Now we Jews, we love the word peace. We love it. It means so much to us. But it's also our weakness. It's our weakness. Because we love that word peace, people use that word. And they say, were you against peace? People say to me all the time, what are you against peace? I go, yeah. Yeah, I'm against peace. I have a war on peace. What? I know, I can see it in the faces. You don't have to, you know, some mouths are gaping. What do you mean war on peace? Because peace doesn't mean what you think it means. It means today Jewish weakness. It means that we have to surrender something. We have to surrender. I need a prop. Somebody give me something of value for a second. Give me that cell phone again. Okay. This is my cell phone. My grandfather gave me the cell phone. His grandfather gave him the cell phone. This is a cell phone passed down from generations and generations of the Fleischer family. Okay? I want to give you this cell phone for peace. Because this is so dear to my heart, I remember my granddad when I think of the cell phone. I give it to you for peace because I want peace with you. And I want you to have this important thing for me because that's how much I value this thing, the peace between us. Will you take this?
Sure.
Okay. How did that feel, everybody? Was that beautiful? That was beautiful, right? Because that was, I gave you something dear to me because I want us to be peaceful and friends. But here in the Middle East, you know what it sounds like? Here's what it sounds like. Take my wife. Do whatever you want. Just don't hurt me. Take my daughter. Just whatever you want. Just let's have peace. Because peace means I am afraid of you. Peace means I'm willing to give up myself for you because you are bigger and stronger. The Middle East, nobody talks about peace. In the Middle East here, when I say I'm willing to negotiate about Jerusalem, because Jerusalem's so dear to me, and I'm willing to divide it for peace. Here's what the other has sounds, the other side hears. Did you just hear him willing to negotiate in Jerusalem? What a spineless, easy to eat up enemy. This is what a joke. He's nothing. He's got no honor. He's willing to give up his mother. He's willing to give up Jerusalem. He's sick. We will defeat him shortly. We will surely defeat him. Let me give you a story about this to make the point. I want to finish up my other point quickly so we can get to questions and answers. Here we go. Here's the story. I meet with Muslims all the time. And oftentimes I do my little spiel with them. Here's what I say. I say, "You're a bad Muslim." "What? You are a bad Muslim. What do you mean?" This happens in cabs and stuff like that. I said, "Well, first thing, the Quran says in 4 different verses that the Jewish people are going to come back to the land of Israel. And here we are. So you don't want to believe in what the Quran says. Moreover, Allah has granted us tremendous victories over you. How could it be? Are we bigger than you? Surely not. Are we richer than you? No. Are we smarter than you? No. Are we bigger? How is it that we beat you every time against your 6 armies? Allah is giving us victory. He has blessed you with 22 countries, and he has given us Al-Quds, Jerusalem, and this land." What happens to the Arab that I speak with? Invariably, they go like this. "Yes, you are right." This happens many times. "Yes, you are right. But, you have left the Sinai. You have left South Lebanon. You left the west parts of the West Bank. And you left Gaza." Gaza, they will say. It could be either Gaza, Gaza, or Gaza. That's what it blames. "And you left Gaza. Gaza. You are shrinking. Allah is against you. We have patience, and you will leave. You want peace now, we have patience. You will be gone in time. You're a microbe, you're a cancer, you'll be cut out. You're a foreigner here." Because you don't act like a Middle Easterner. Middle Easterner would never negotiate about Jerusalem. It's ridiculous. You have a short time here. You came here like other empires came here, you're going to be gone soon. All you are is just an American, European, white man, foreigner. You're going to be gone soon enough. Lest you think that what I'm talking about is a joke, let me make it a little bit sharper for you, okay? I work in Hebron. About a year ago, there was that whole stabbing era. Still continues today. We, in the last month, lost 2 fathers, 2 rabbis who actually knew one another. There's a picture now of them together. Did you see the picture? They're from similar neighborhoods, close neighborhoods. 2 men have been murdered horrifically. But in that, what happened, and it was also an attempt just yesterday, and the perpetrator was shot and killed, the terrorist. I was in Hebron, and the security guy ran right past me, and I'm like, "Yoni, what's going on?" He says, "Get in the car and get your camera out." Okay. I jump in the security car, he turns on the sirens, boom, he flies towards the place. We get out. The army's already all there. The situation seems to be under control. I look around. I see a girl bleeding out on the floor in a twisted. When people get shot, they don't look like a person who fell. There's something weird about the way they look. And she's on the floor, and she's bleeding out. She's still moving a little bit, but she's been shot by a few bullets, I'm guessing. The doctors in this room know that you can't really see it, but you see a person, you see the blood rolling down the street. And I happen to walk closer to this person who is not yet dead but dying. I look at the girl and I notice one thing. I'm a regular man like everybody else. I noticed she was very beautiful. Very beautiful girl. Very beautiful Arab girl. And also I noticed that she's very well dressed. What was obvious to me that she was a girl from a wealthy house. And it turned out that I was right. She was from Bethlehem, from a wealthy Arab house. And that day she took a scissors from her mom's drawer and decided to stab a soldier. She was beautiful, she was young, she was wealthy. Why would she decide to die that day? Does that make sense to you? What do you think about that? Why did she do that? Now she tried to stab a soldier and nothing really happened and they shot her dead. That was the whole thing. But why did she do that? Because she feels herself to be part of a great train of history, of Islam conquering the world. She's bought into the jihadist thing. And she sees Israel shrinking. And she thinks, okay, today's a great day. Maybe she has some issue, maybe whatever, but today's a great day for me to be part of this train. How do you defeat that? Some of you may think there's no way to defeat that, right? You're wrong. There is a way to defeat that. And our great rabbi, Zev Jabotinsky, told us many years ago what the answer is. Give them a sense that they will never get 1 inch from us. That the war against us is futile. Futile. We will defeat you. We will beat you. We're never, ever leaving. I'm not doing anything for peace. I'm here to be strong. You will never move me. I'm a post-Holocaust nation. You shall not be successful against me. Not a little bit. Not in Gaza, not in Sinai, not in South Lebanon. When I come to this place and you mess with me, when I take your land, it's mine forever. Don't start with me. And here, I told you a story about this point number two, about peace. I'm finishing off with the last point, which is one of the most detestable new forms of Israeli Hasbara, which many of you have bought into, and I'm going to try my best to disabuse you of this idea, is the moral army narrative. Israel's got a moral army. True? Yeah, have you used this? Have you said to people, but we have a very moral army? You've heard it's a tactic, right? Have you guys heard this? We have a moral army, right? You haven't heard it? Oh, no, it's a recurrent thing. We have a very moral army. We do our best to minimize casualties. We're always trying so darn hard to make sure that the civilian population isn't hurt, etc. And we're always, you know, very, very, very moral. And I think this is the worst thing in the world. Okay, stop, pause. Everybody, asterisk, listen good. Everybody perk up your ears and hear me say clearly. I'm not saying that we don't have a moral army or that we shouldn't have a moral army. We do have a moral army, and we should have a moral army, but we don't have to sell it that way. Don't promote it that way. Have a moral army. In Israel, by the way, we call it purity of arms. Have a moral army. That's great. But don't tell people that. Tell them that you have a badass army. Do not mess with us. Do not mess with us. We're a post-Holocaust people, and we are absolutely intolerant of injury to Jews. That is a normal message. My army, I have a democratic country. My army is a bad bulldog with a bad temper that I unleashed. If you mess with me, I will not even be able to control this thing. That is what Israel used to be like. Plucky. What's it called? Unpredictable. Not, you know, here's my bodyguard, but don't worry about him. He's really nice. Here's my pit bull. All right, buddy, got no teeth. What kind of thing is this? What kind of thing is this? You don't tell people that you have a moral army. And there's a haughtiness in there, too. We're not like you. We're above you. I don't say that. I'm not trying to be better than. Maybe I am better than, but I'm not trying to promote that. I have an army that stops you from hurting us. And now here's the story. This is my last story. Unless there's like another story question here. Here's the story. True story, you can see it for yourself. I was on Al Jazeera during the Gaza War. They invited me to Al Jazeera. And you know, I knew what they were going to ask me. They were going to ask me about how many, you know, people they have injured on their side, 2,000 people dead on their side, 70 people on our side. So I asked a very famous Israeli reporter, who I think has spoken here as well, very famous Israeli reporter, is a friend of mine, I'm not going to mention his name. I said to him, buddy, I'm going in Al Jazeera in 30 minutes. What do you think I should say? He says, Yishai, talk about how moral our army is. Tell them how much we try not to hurt children and not to hurt innocent people. Right? I said to him, pal, do you know how dumb that is? This is a seasoned reporter. Why? here's me going into the more army narrative, and there's a guy, is anybody here in television? Is there anybody who works in television? There's a dude, there's the moderator and maybe the other panelists, and then there's a guy behind in the video room that's just waiting to cue up the images of some kid being pulled out of the rubble. And so when Yishai, Rabbi Yishai, the settler Jew, is going to start saying, oh, we have such a moral army, we try so hard. They're going to play a video of a kid being pulled out of the rubble with his limbs hanging out. And I'm going to look like the biggest liar. And they're just going to make a total mockery. And there's going to be the dude, he's ready to queue up the video. Okay, he says, so what are you going to do? I say, watch this. I get to Al Jazeera. And they go, but this is all on video, you can see yourself. But Mr. Fleischer, how do you explain that there are 2,000 casualties on the Palestinian side and only 70 on the Israeli side? I said to them, that's exactly what happens when you start with us. That is what happens when you start with us. You shoot at us, we're going to shoot at you 10 times as hard. Do not start with Israel. The Chiron guy, I could hear him. Should I play the cue now? I'm not going to get into trying to tell you that my army's moral. Don't start with us. Yes, we will kill a lot. And I said, if you put your children in front of our rockets, you'll be the murderer. Okay? But we will not allow you to harm our children and our bodies. Later in the program, they circled back to this. And they said to me, but Mr. Fleischer, how is it that Hamas has lobbed 3,000 rockets and only 70 Israelis have been killed? So I said, well, to answer that, I have to take off my reporter hat and put on my rabbi hat. Allah is swiping away the rockets. He's swatting them away. What do you think? I said, what do you think? Hamas doesn't know how to aim? What are they, stupid? Allah's protecting the Jews. The Chiron guy is a little confused. None of this, like, Woody Allen type of answers. You know what I mean? A chance of her. We have a little country. We have every right to defend it. We are 6.5 million amongst 350 million. We have every right to exist. We are the small minority. We have a right to defend ourselves. In short, my friends, we've talked about three different issues, which I think are important. Remember, what do we say first? The big picture? Things are good. Thank God, right? Baruch Hashem. But vis-a-vis settlers, I think that we should talk about these issues. And I think we should talk about our rights in this land. Of course, we need to also talk about a different talk that we're not going to do tonight. Do we have alternatives to the two-state solution? Maybe we'll talk about the questions. But I am going to embrace what I am, which I think that the people I work for are heroes of Israel, pioneers of Israel, holding on to our ancestral homeland. That's number one. Two, with regard to the word peace, it's a dangerous word. Oh, now, I heard that you have some tension in this country. I heard something about some political tensions with the president, some people don't like it. Am I right about this? I heard about this, right? Some issue going on here. Any case, I'm not going to comment in any partisan way, because at the end of the day, though I am American and proud of it and thankful for this country and many of the gifts that it gave our people and certainly my family, I am a Zionist and I live in Israel and I don't vote in the American elections. I don't. Principally, I do not vote, although my friends say you should vote because the issues impact us. But by principle, since I'm not interested I'm not involved in the minutia of this country's day-to-day life, I don't know if I have its best interests at heart. I don't vote principally. So I'm not going to come to you as a Republican or a Democrat. I could just talk, and I'm not going to talk to you about President Trump either. I'm going to talk about policies. I can tell you that the policies recently of recognizing Jerusalem, of starting to defund UNRWA, starting to pulling out of UNESCO, criminalizing people like Ismail Haniyeh, it's making the fraud, the Palestinian side is showing its true face. They are so viscerally angry, so viscerally hateful against America, against Israel, and I think that's fabulous. Why? Because at least it's not fake peace. Fake peace is something that we fall for. Yasser Arafat was a mass murderer and a big, big hater of Israel. And yet, he's shaking hands with Prime Minister Rabin and getting the Nobel Peace Prize and standing on the White House lawn. We fell for fake peace. Why? Because we love peace. Because we're good-hearted. Me too. But we can't afford that because that fakes us out. We are, thank God, now in a period that fake peace is over. And I'm very, very thankful for that. And finally, moral army is something that you have. It's not something you promote. We have a moral army, but we have to continue to promote deterrence and strength. I want to thank you so much for being with me tonight. Okay, hold on a second, John. We're going to do it in a special format.
We'll sit up here. We got half an hour. We'll do.
Okay, so we're going to do questions and answers. Our good friend Jake is going to, and then we're going to raffle off wine so nobody leaves, okay? Where's that hat there it is. Everybody put it in? Everybody put in a note? Last chance, okay? You're holding it, maybe somebody else wants to put it in.
We got water for you as well.
So that'll buy.
You know Ronan?
Absolutely. Ronan is a military analyst, but also an investigative reporter about Israel's Mossad, all the secret missions. Ronan Bergman is always the first guy.
So he wrote a piece talking about the moral question, and it's interesting from within the Israeli milieu, looking at military decisions and morality, and he writes this piece that concludes that after 2002, Israel went from being David to being Goliath because there was a shift from trying to arrest terrorists in the midst of the Second Intifada and massive violence to trying to eliminate or assassinate terrorists and the people who were funding them and organizing them and orchestrating them. And I was in the Israeli army in the 2 years prior to this decision period, but 2 years of Intifada. And I remember feeling very frustrated with our government in Israel that they didn't take the war further. So they would send our squad to go respond every time someone was shooting at a military base or a tank base or a road or a power plant, and we would go and respond to the shooter. But what are we doing about? So here he talks about a decision that was made to go after the guys that were getting them there. But I have to say I disagree with his conclusions, and I want to hear your thoughts on it, because even if you get all of the guys that are involved, you still get more people coordinating, planning, and carrying out the attacks, because the base of it isn't a terrorist in a terrorist organization planning an attack, but the education system of hatred and anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. And where does that come from? There's funding from UNESCO and from UNRWA and from churches and governments of the European Union. And this is all coming to the Palestinians with a narrative that keep those keys, remember Haifa, remember Yafo, you'll get it back someday. So it's a question and a commentary about a sense of morality in Israel that doesn't believe in fighting the war all the way.
With your question, you're asking something that a lot of times I might spare American audiences or foreign audiences from really dealing with these issues, because what you're really asking is, are we not complicit? The deeper question we're asking, the next stage is, are we not complicit in much of the jihad against us? For example, Gaza is fully, the electricity in Gaza comes from Israel. 700 trucks of food and medicine come through every day from Israel. Most of the cement that goes to building the tunnels comes every day from Israel. And this is a hard thing to actually talk about in front of audiences out here. The fact is that we, Israel, is the enabler of Palestine, Palestinianism that is anti-Israelism. And that happens every day. But I will also, but in order to make it very clear to you, crystal clear to you, that we do that is, you went all the way to the field. Let's just go to the heart of it all. Let's go to our own Knesset. We have in our Knesset members who are treasonous. Treasonous. Today, most of the Arab Knesset members, and I only say most so as to not fall, but really the truth is all the Arab Knesset members believe in Palestine replacing Israel altogether. And by the way, I want to make a point to you. Lest you think that maybe it's because Palestinians are somehow abused and that's why they're fighting against Israel, look at the Druze. The Druze, it rhymes with Jews, right? The Druze are an Arab-like people. You call them Arabs, they don't like it. They speak Arabic. They look Arabic. They're a different religion altogether, but they're a non-Arab people. But they're, in many ways, culturally very similar to Arabs. Yet they live in Israel. Some of them are generals in our army. The head of the Golani Brigade was a Druze. Do you understand what that means? You know what that means. The Golani Brigade, right, was a Druze. We have Druze Knesset members who are more Zionist than... by the way, the most Zionist speech ever given at the Knesset was a certain vice president recently. It really rocked people. It was an incredible thing. But back to our issue. What's the difference between the Druze and the Palestinians? Is one... I get it. We oppress Palestinians because we don't like them, but we like the Druze. Of course not. Jews like minorities. There's no difference. There's only one difference. The Druze don't have jihadism. They believe in being subservient to the host state, to the sovereign. And the Palestinians today have succumbed to jihadism. But that also is happening in our Knesset. If we're not willing to take a seditious Knesset member and put him in jail, then we're sending a signal. I'll give you another signal. 14-year-old kids that throw rocks get a pass because they're children. Have you ever had a rock thrown at you? I have, and at my kids as well. And you know what it is? A rock is a murderous weapon. Okay?
The first murderous weapon.
Huh? Yeah, that's right. A rock is a very... Now what happens when a 14-year-old kid throws a rock and he gets a pass? What signal does he get? This is okay. And you actually destroy that kid's life when you don't arrest him and you don't teach him a lesson. What happens? He goes into a life of crime. It gives him a green light signal at the beginning of his life. Criminalize him, throw him in jail, make sure his parents pay through the nose. Teach a lesson, say, no, this is not acceptable. And you will actually save that kid's life. Sometimes liberalism is actually the most destructive thing. When you're kind to them, in that moment, you're actually unkind to society. You end up condoning this kind of en masse violence. And so, yeah, Israel's kind of weak right now, and that's why, that's the zoom-in issues that we had before. Like we have not made that decision that we will root this out on the every mosque, every social media level, every school level, we will root this thing out. We have not decided that. We are in argument. A person like me has a very clear position, but Israel today is debating. Not everybody's on my side. In Israel, we have a plurality for the nationalist perspective, but a very strong and vociferous tendency to the other side, which really sees the Palestinians as having a legitimate claim, and that we are the abusers, etc. So we're having that debate. What I represent to you today is not Israel, but a segment of Israel that has, we think, a direction of the solution. But that's the debate that's happening in Israel, and in the end, that leads to that frustration that you felt.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll open it up to questions in the interest of time. I'll start right in front.
What are your views on the future of coexistence?
Repeat it.
Yeah, go ahead.
What are your views on the future of coexistence?
Okay, so I think I forgot to mention before, maybe I mentioned in passing, I don't like the word peace, but I do like a term that I made up called inter-Semitic cooperation. I'm into inter-Semitic cooperation. I believe in inter-Semitic cooperation. We are, by the way, something that I remind liberal campus kids a lot of times. I say to them, you know, we are not very different than the Arabs. We're genetically very, very close, linguistically very close, even religiously quite close. Understand that we're a Middle Eastern people. Behave like a Middle Eastern people, you will fit in. I think that, first thing you should know, that there is a big change right now. Saudi Arabia is toning down its anti-Israel rhetoric because they have learned the Torah, they study Rav Kook, and they have become just big Zionists. Is that right? Is that why? No? It's because they love our high-tech segment and they want to make money. Is that why? Huh? Qataris, yeah. What? Well, the Qataris are honest to God jihadists. Why are the Saudis so interested in Israel being there? Right. What?
Buy and sell services with no trade. Trade.
No, it's not trade. It's Iran. It's a four-letter word. It's Iran. Iran. You have to understand. Iran are Iranians. The Iranian. You know what? I don't like to say the word Iran. Let's be a little bit clear. Let's call it what they are. The Iranian regime. The Iranian people. There's a sorry lot. There's a people that's repressed. Really. If you want to know how Iranian people actually think, go to Los Angeles and see how the million Iranians in Los Angeles, what they think of the Iranian regime. They detest it. Have you ever seen such an expat group of people detest their own government back home? It's a fact. What do the Iranians want? They want Mecca and Medina. How much they want it, they want it. And they're willing to do very nasty things. The Saudis are not Zionists, neither labor Zionists, nor political Zionists, nor religious Zionists. They're not. They are people who are actually, with all of their sword dances. By the way, can I make a little parenthetical thing? A little parenthetical thing that bothers me. Why is it that when Donald Trump, or any president, an important person, goes to Saudi Arabia, you do a sword dance, right? And then when you come to Israel, we show you the wall, the tears. 2,000 years ago, they destroyed our temple. Next day, lay a wreath at Yad Vashem. 70 years ago, they tried to kill our people. But in Saudi Arabia, you do the sword dance. You know, come on, can we shortcut that whole sad bit? Do it, but just do it kind of quick and then go on to, like, I'd like to see Vice President Pence, we're now putting you into our new Merkava 4 tank. Mr. Vice President, do you spot the enemy? Press the button, boom! You know, that's amazing, all right? You know, show them the stuff. Don't always make it about the Woody Allen thing. I'm not into it. And God forbid, please don't misunderstand. I actually think the Holocaust education is very important, et cetera, all that. But like, and I pray at the Western Wall, all that. But like, don't always sell it like, oi, oi, oi. You know, it's like, sell it chazak. Don't always sell it like, you know, like a lot of people have been killed and persecuted. That's not why Israel exists, because we've been persecuted. It bothers me. Where were we? Saudi Arabia. These guys are not good. They do the sword dance, but they're actually awful fighters. They know how to spend money on jets. They don't know how to fly them, okay? These guys, they have been forever under the defense umbrella of the United States of America. United States of America, especially under President Obama, has removed itself from being an actor, a physical actor in the Middle East. And they know that Iran will do anything to take over Mecca and Medina. Why? Because that is Islamic legitimacy. If you're a Shiite, you don't have control of Mecca and Medina, the Sunnis do, that means that you are not really responsible for the Prophet Muhammad. You're not the boss, and they want to be the boss. So now the Saudis are saying, we actually want Israel to protect us. That's actually what they want. They want our defense umbrella, and I've also heard, according to foreign reports, that we may have some nuclear capabilities as well. And so, thank you. And so they want our defense umbrella. But what is their problem? The Palestinians. They can't be seen as totally giving up on the Palestinian issue. So they say to the Palestinians, accept this, and shut up already. And the Palestinians say, what? We are a proud people, all that business, right? And what's happening with the Palestinians? The Saudis are going to turn their back. This is what's going to happen in the near future. Saudis are going to turn their back on the Palestinians because they're afraid for their very life. They're going to say, forget you, we need Israel's help. Where are the Palestinians going? Iran. Today, the PA is falling apart. The major move of the Palestinians is towards Hamas being a Iranian puppet, proxy, and Hezbollah. That's where we're going. We're going to Israel versus Iran axis, with the Palestinian movements falling under the Iranian sphere of influence. That's not so bad, because at least it's not fake peace. Hot war, we can handle. We're good at hot war. We're bad at peace. That's where we fail. So I'm not so worried about it, but that's the direction it's going. Cooperation with the Saudis, yes. With the United Arab Emirates, yes. with Arabs who have come to accept the fact that we're not going anywhere. Yes, inter-Semitic cooperation. Peace? No. Because that's not the way it works in the Middle East. Strength? Yes. Inter-Semitic cooperation? Yes. Got to push back on the Iranian and everybody that falls under their rubric.
Let's take the next question from Lenny.
Don't get back to that.
On a personal level, I was in Hebron a couple of years ago. We snuck in with a journalist with a gun in a car, and if my husband ever knew that I think he's learning this for the first time tonight. And at the time, I was in the home of a Jewish home, and across the street, Palestinians were doing some building, and everything seemed okay, but we were very anxious and nervous. So I'm asking you, I'm zooming in on a personal level. What is it like for your wife, your kids, your friends, your family, every day in Hebron?
Okay, first thing, for clarity's sakes, I live nearby in Judea in the town of Ephrat. Right. Ephrat.
That's Rabbi
from New York. Right, Ephrat, where like 5,000 American Jews live in big fat houses. Yeah. Ephrat, you know, a bedroom community of Jerusalem. Ephrat. Huh? Bedroom community of New York City, that's right. But at the same time, though, by the way, Ephrat, a town nestled between many Arab neighborhoods, and the Gush Junction, one of the most dangerous places in all of Israel. Many attacks have happened. So that's where I live. I get up in the morning, and I take my kids to school nearby, which is considered one of the best schools in Israel, and then to Taekwondo class, and all that kind of stuff. And then I go to Hebron, I drive. And it takes 30 minutes to get to Hebron. Hebron, Jewish Hebron, is an enclave of 92 families in a city, an ancient city, that has 180,000 Arabs today. By the way, in 1967, it had 5,000 Arabs. And it's not their birth rate. They've come from all over the Arab world, and even Israel, to settle. Hebron is, by the way, the wealthiest of the Palestinian Authority cities. One of the things that the anti-Israel crowd talks about is that Hebron has become a ghost town because some of the storefronts have been closed down by the IDF because there were terrorists sneaking in and out through these storefronts. That's true on 1 kilometer, one street. The rest is one of the most bustling Arab cities in the Middle East and certainly in Israel, with 5 billion shekels of exports to Israel. Hebron is a town that the people that live there have a tremendous sense of satisfaction that they're continuing a tradition of 3,800 years. It's not an easy town to live in, also because it's about an hour from Jerusalem, an hour from Beer Sheva, and an hour from Beit Shemesh. Where is the nearest big city? Hebron. It's a big city, but the problem is Jews are not allowed in 97% of the city. So the Palestinian claim that we are practicing apartheid because some stores have been closed, storefronts, and yet we, this tiny ethnic minority in this town, is not allowed into 97%, we're not allowed as an ethnic group to go into. So who's under apartheid?
Can you talk about what that means to not be allowed in to 97%?
The Israeli army has checkpoints, and we're the ones that are not allowed to go through a checkpoint. The Arabs come through this area, they get checked, like in the airport. By the way, that's another misnomer, that checkpoints are somehow extremely... The checkpoint in Hebron is much quicker than an airport checkpoint here. It's not the most pleasant thing in the world, but it's also not some kind of, what's the word that they use?
Humiliation.
It's not. It's a security check. It's annoying, but we all always get annoyed by security checks. Stop the terror, there won't be checks, right? To answer your question, we have about 500,000 visitors a year to Hebron, of pilgrims, people coming to pray, connect, history. We have a bus every hour from the central bus station in Jerusalem. Recently, they made it. There used to be these buses where the windows were. It's bulletproof buses. Bulletproof buses. But there used to be these bad windows, you know, these thick glass. Today it's beautiful new technology, great new windows. Bus, brand new bus takes you every hour from Central Bus Station in Jerusalem to Hebron. Buses are full. People are coming all the time. And my job is to normalize as much as possible this great historic site. You know who's buried in Hebron? Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca, Jacob and Leah, these couples. And so I'm borrowing a term from Virginia. Virginia is for lovers. Hebron is for lovers, okay? It's the city of couples. And we're trying to normalize it as much as possible. It's a tough city because most of it is also controlled by the Hamas. So we have bad guys, including the mayor of Arab Hebron, is a guy named by the name of Yasir Abu Snenna. You can look him up and you'll see a video translated to English where he boasts that in 1980 he was involved in the killing of six Jews, the murder of six Jews in Beit Hadassah. He sat in prison for 2 years and then got out one of the deals, and today he's the mayor. How do we know that he's one of the guys involved? Because he boasts about it. I was able to kill Jews in 1980, give me your vote, I could do it again. So it's a tough place, but I'm going to say something which is not very fashionable, and that is, courage is still a value. Courage is a value. Remember that, folks. Courage is a value. Today, in the atmosphere where everything is about safety and about personal individual rights, it's almost like courage is not a value. It's not important. Courage is a value. Courage is a value. And the people of Hebron engage in courage so that people like you and me can come and visit every day and say,
Can you comment a little bit about the Haredi in Jerusalem and the IDF with the Haredi movement, the all Haredi units, and Haredis at the wall, with the women at the wall, and what kind of message is all sending to American Jews?
Okay, so Haredi is black hat, ultra-Orthodox, that kind of Jew. You know, I'll tell you, first thing I want to say, Dr. Lafferty, that this is not my issue so much. Just honestly, it's just not my issue. And not because I don't think it's an unimportant issue. It is an important issue. It's just not my issue because I'm a frontline fighter for the Jewish people in places like Hebron and our rights, which are under attack, and the whole occupation, that whole business. So I'm not dealing with it. The ultra-Orthodox, one has to also take off the hat to them. They're amazingly reproductive. They're not so productive, but amazingly reproductive. And as I said to the Arabs before, Allah loves you. So too, God loves them somehow, and they're able to really, they're a growing segment in Israel. What message does that send to American Jewry? I don't think it's sending a message to American Jewry, it just is. Jewish people are growing, and the segment is growing, you know? When you say American Jewry, I think what you mean is reform, conservative, and the liberal tendency that feel alienated by this kind of Jewry. Okay. We're not able to control population growth. So this is not China here, you know? It just that is what's happening. And if American Jewry feels distanced from Israel, well, there's a cultural truth to that. And by the way, that's also true here in America. You could go to New York City. I was in Englewood, and I saw a synagogue. And they told me, listen, 50 years ago, this Reform synagogue brought out Governor Rockefeller to their dinner. Now they don't even have a dinner. There's a truth about the shrinking of the Reform conservative. If you ever watch there's an interview with Rav Kahana with Larry King. So Larry King says, Rabbi Meir Kahani joins me today. He's an Orthodox rabbi, maybe one of the last. It's on YouTube. He says, maybe one of the last. So okay, it turns out that there's a growth today in America and in Israel of that segment of the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox thing. I don't have any comment on that. I don't have, you know, that's true. If you feel distance from it, well, you know, one thing I can tell you, which I have to tell American Jews a lot of times, do not expect that Israel will always be responsive to whatever your morals or religious needs are in America. Israel is very responsive, and its government is responsive to the needs of Israelis, because that's who votes for them. Plus, remember, we don't live in a nice system we have here in America. When is the next election in America? In 3 years. On which day is it? What? Right? There's a day. You know when the next election is. Right? Yeah, okay. We don't have that in Israel. Every Monday, there are votes of no confidence. Every Monday, there's a vote of no confidence, and if it passes, the government automatically dissolves. The Prime Minister of Israel comes every Monday, he could lose his job, and the government dissolves. Every Monday, and when I say every Monday, I'm not saying that figuratively. I mean literally. And so therefore, understand that Israel's government responds to its needs every week, and it's not always conservative. I was told for American Jews, like liberal Jews get upset and stuff, I say, okay, come to Israel and be, you know, and be part of it. With regard to the Western Wall, I'm going to say something that may sound a little shocking to some of you. The Western Wall is not the holiest place for the Jewish people. Jewish people started praying in the Western Wall in the year 1655. Beforehand, they prayed on the Southern Wall, sometimes on the Mount of Olives, always in proximity to the Temple Mount. You know that Golden Dome? That's where we have two temples. That's where our Holy of Holies. It's not at the Western Wall. The Western Wall was the shopping plaza where you got your nails done and you bought like some sheep to go up to the Temple Mount. It was the Mamilla of yesteryear, okay? That's the Western Wall. Now, the Western Wall is the only wall that continues to stand from 2,000 years ago, except for also the southern, eastern, and northern walls, okay? They're all totally standing. The Western Wall goes for, it's basically a kilometer by kilometer, it basically goes for a long time more into the Arab quarter, and also goes more to the south. It's been opened up more. It's been created. Now, some people talk about the Western Wall having an Orthodox area and then a conservative or reform or liberal area. I think that that is so wrong. There's a men's section, a women's section, and a family section. I'm Orthodox. I avail myself of the family section often when I want to bring my daughter to the Western Wall. So, you know, she could experience this, what was the shopping plaza 2,000 years ago. And so just to understand that, like, now they have opened up more of this wall section for folks who are annoyed or want more mixed space, not in the Orthodox section. Oh, by the way, it goes down. Just as big as it is there, it goes down more than the whole size of it. It's a massive wall. But we have this fixation, which I find to be this particular spot. It's a kind of a mythology that's been created. I don't buy into it, okay? I am a Temple Mount going Jew. And I go up there, and today, here's a shocker, the state of Israel enforces the jihadist laws, the Dahibitut laws. If you want to go back to see what it was like under Dahibitut, go to the Temple Mount as a Jew, and you will be subjected to not being allowed to pray. The one place a Jew is not allowed to pray is the only place for the Jewish people. It's absurd. It's absurdity. And so I'll finish it up. I go up to the Temple Mount, they don't let me pray like this, but I pray inside my heart, inside, you know. I pray, that's where we go to pray. And there are certainly issues there, and the ultra-Orthodox are sometimes problematic, the liberal Jews, we're all problematic. Guess what? We're cantankerous lies. Okay? But I don't let those issues, and I recommend if anybody lets those issues dissuade you from a love of Israel, from a connection to Israel, check yourself. Is that just not an excuse for you to distance yourself? Or if it is indeed making you feel different about it, okay. Don't let that be your Israel. There's so much beautiful stuff happening. There's so much. Don't let, we are just being born in our land. We're so young in our land, you know? Let's not let those divisions, it's time for healing those divisions. And yes, those other side, they also need to learn to be a little bit more accepting. I agree with that. But I wouldn't let that stuff distance American Jewry. And that's why I'm here, by the way. Why am I here today? Because I believe in holding hands across the Atlantic. And I believe that every single one of us in this room has to, I'm saying this with a joke, but just so be patient, every single one of us has to make Aliyah. What do I mean by that? You want to make all the other Israel good, move to Israel. But what's your hobby? Is it to buy an apartment in Israel and rent it out? Is it to drink wine from the land of Israel? What's your aliyah? Is it to develop a beautiful photo that you took in Israel and put it in your living room and walk past every day and say, wow, it's beautiful? What's our step? What's our step? I went to law school here in America. One guy goes every summer and works as a lawyer at nighttime so his family could have a summer in Israel. And he brings his family to Israel every summer. That's his aliyah. And another guy, another lawyer, doesn't do that. But he just hires Israelis that live in Israel to his law firm in America. They work remotely and they make good American money. What is your aliyah? So my belief is that we have to hold hands across the Atlantic as much as possible. What's our trip to Israel? What's our, you know, when is our temple and synagogue or JCC, when is it going on the trip? How are we connected? I know here we have also, you know, Shirut here probably, right? But come here, that's amazing. What is our way? Look at Jay, who's all day making Aliyah every day by connecting us to the land of Israel and many people in this community. That is, to me, what this time is about. This time is an opportunity. This time is a time not of separating yourself from Israel. It's a time to plug in as much as possible in any possible way. Don't let the Haredim make you feel outside of Israel. That's silly. We're living in a great time of revelation. We have to plug in.
That very positive note. I know we've got a lot of hands up with questions. I think Yishai can stick around for a little bit longer, but out of respect for everyone's time, I want us to wrap up on time as scheduled. It's 8:30, so
one more.
Do one.
This maybe this one's over here.
Yes, it is.
And it's a Kansas neighbor. Yes.
Okay. And the second one is there a plan to be made to expand or build Hebron either horizontally or vertically? Is that ever talked about? I always hear about people talking about holding on desperately for this scraps up Hebron, but is there talk of like, all right, what about pushing out to Joseph's tomb? Or what about, you know what I mean?
Joseph's tomb is in Shechem, in Nablus. Just by the way, that's a little thing that you hear. Yesterday, the Times of Israel, they have a little problem. This news organization, they always write the word Nablus. Nablus is Shechem, a very ancient and important Jewish city. That is the Greek name for it, which is Neapolis. Nablus is the mispronunciation of Neapolis. Neapolis is Neopolis, new city. The Romans built it in Shechem. That's where the tomb of Joseph is. Today, it's under the Palestinian Authority, and Jews can barely get to the tomb of Joseph. That's a whole separate issue. With regard to Hebron, thank you for asking that question. We recently got permission to build 31 apartments that we're going to build, and we're going to we're going to sell them outright. The project is going to cost $17 million. We're going to sell the apartments for a cheap rate, relatively, because Hebron is not easy to sell there. And we're also going to develop kindergartens and public spaces. We're going to get income of $10 million when we finish building it. And we're missing $7 million. One of the things that I've been doing on this trip is meeting with folks who are helping out. We're going to raise that $7 million. And we're going to build a $17 million project, 31 apartments in Hebron, and that's going to open it right up. And it's for me, very exciting. Boss in Hebron is the director general of the community, Uri Karzan, and I think this is going to be his signature project. I remember in 2005 that we celebrated the building of a beautiful building called Beit Menachem, where archaeology from Jewish presence from 3,000 years ago was found underneath. That was finished in 2005. I hope that 15 years later, by 2020, we will see a new Jewish neighborhood in Hebron. And I am personally excited. That's what gets me excited, is to be involved in a building project like this. So that hopefully will be a good one. And on that note, I want to thank you again. I want to thank you, Jake, so much. I want to thank the JCC. I want to thank the BJE and McCor and all of you so much for coming. Thank you.
I want to add a comment on that last story about building these homes. Thank you. When you read in the newspaper about Israel committing this horrible crime of allowing settlements to be built, allowing homes to be built, What is that horrible crime? It's actually the crime of liberalism, of allowing Jews to build in their ancestral homeland, the crime of allowing Jews to add an addition onto their house so they have an extra room, so instead of having their 8 sons and daughters all live in one room, they can actually have a boys' room and a girls' room. And this is something that's criminalized in the press, but it's really, in my eyes, and I hope after meeting Yishai in your eyes as well, if it wasn't already, it's a beautiful thing. It's Israel being rebuilt and reestablished. And when you hear talk of the crime of building in East Jerusalem, well, that includes the old city of Jerusalem, that includes Maale Adumim, that includes these areas where after the Jordanians conquered and occupied that area in 48, all the Jews were kicked out, the synagogues were destroyed, and it's being rebuilt today. Like the garden is being replanted, and new flowers are blooming, and this is a beautiful thing, and I think it's all we need to have. Another round of applause, because we're so happy to have you here. Thank you. All right, here we go.